Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR's College of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio. Fantasy literature has held readers in thrall over millennia. The C.S. Lewis Chronicles of Narnia are a relatively recent example, and a resurgence of interest with Tolkien's Lord of the Rings saw that interest explode with the Harry Potter books and Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials. So, when I heard of Patrick Rothfuss, how his Kingkiller Chronicle was earning rave reviews, and that he was coming to Little Rock, I leapt the chance to talk to him. Did I mention that I'm a fantasy fan? It was in May, and Patrick was in town working with the Heifer organization and made time to visit our station for an interview, where he filled in some of his background and his path to the vast world of fantasy. His use of the word chronicle interested me, and why he planned his story as a trilogy. The first two books, already out in paperback, Day One, The Name of the Wind, Day Two, The Wise Man's Fear, but he used chronicle in its singular form.
And I think that's actually a little more appropriate, given that the Narnia books are a series of stories related, but each sufficient unto itself, whereas mine is really a large story in three volumes.
Not having read the first one, my imagination is titillated at the thought of returning to the beginning, because there is a link at the start of this one that is obviously an awakening from the day before of the first book, and presumably will follow a pattern toward the end of this one. And then possibly this third book will bring some revelations and maybe surprise us all. But the King Killer, does that assume that the first book, in fact, kills the king?
No.
The king is dead already?
No, there's actually a lot of speculation as to that right now, because through the first book and then the second book, and everyone, I started with a smaller story, no clashing armies or huge world-shaking events. I really wanted to tell a smaller story about a person's life. And when that person is younger, then typically those events tend to be like cozier, more personal.
And yet have an inevitable effect on the years that come.
Exactly.
And setting is a little bit like Philip Pullman's, more related to what we know of the Middle Ages and before then, in terms of, or the description of the country in which, now you'll have to tell me his name.
Kvothe.
It struck me, I mentioned before we went on the air that I had loved Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials. It has the same indeterminate, more so than yours does, of switching because of his parallel universes, which I love. I love that concept, that you can't really latch in on a particular era or belief system. But he does have, what I sense in your book, this antagonism to religion, specifically Christianity and the Roman Catholicism and its control.
Yeah, there's not much doubt about that in Pullman's work.
And I see that you do much the same with academia.
Oh.
With the power that the academics have over the lowly students, and how you really do have to have some special burning. Kvothe explains why he will suffer any punishment, because he needs to know. He has within him a knowledge that's not yet satisfied. And I just wondered how you created him.
Well, that really is at the core of his character, is the desire to know. But as far as how I created him, I've read fantasy my whole life. My very first non-picture books were the Narnia Chronicles, and then I read The Dragon Riders of Pern, and then I read everything, like quite literally, like a novel a day, maybe two novels a day, all through my teenage years, all through high school, then into college. And so that easily stacks up to a couple thousand novels. And at that age, you're more voracious than discriminatory. And so I was happy with anything. You know, I didn't have a lot of critical faculties at 14.
Were you writing at the same time?
I kind of liked the idea of writing. I tried to write a computer game back then because I knew a little bit about computers. I might have dabbled with some stories or some poetry, but no, I was mostly a reader. And then eventually I did make it into college. And I, at that point, I had started a really awful high school fantasy novel. And I eventually gave it up because I realized it was a train wreck of a story. It was terribly, terribly cliche. But then, you know, I was in college and I read Chaucer and I read Shakespeare, really read Shakespeare instead of, you know, what you might do in high school, and read Frost and Gwendolyn Brooks and like some of these really amazing writers. And in my own personal reading too, not just in the classroom, I remember stumbling into Cyrano de Bergerac, and I read that and I was just like amazed. The translation is, I got the good translation by Brian Hooker. Mm-hmm. And I read it in the first half. I'm like, what an amazing character. And then the second half I read like through a sheet of tears. You know, it's a beautiful Saturday afternoon. I'm inside just weeping over this story, and it breaks my heart. And then somehow it breaks my heart again, twice in a row. And it just destroys me for the whole day. And I remember thinking, why have I never read a fantasy novel with a character this good that has never like just punched me in the heart? And which is not to say that I didn't love The Lord of the Rings, or that, you know, that I didn't maybe occasionally get some tear jerking happening in some of these novels. But I remember thinking, it's like, where is this? Why don't we have this and fantasy? And then I read shortly thereafter Casanova's memoirs, which were fascinating because it was just the story of a man's life, and no dragons and no swashbuckling sword fights and no clashing armies of orcs and no apocalypse. But it was still fascinating, this person living in interesting times, telling about the events of his life. And I thought, well, maybe you don't need to always have a dragon and a magical sword. And the wheels started to turn in my head. And so I had the idea of telling just a person's story, a smaller story told well, an interesting person, the events of a life. And that's where it started. That's where he came from.
So to do that, you had to put him in a very special setting where whatever happens to him is believable because it bears no resemblance to what one grows up with nowadays. There are too many man-made artifacts that interfere with the special world of fantasy.
Yeah, that's possible. I defaulted to this particular world because, well, if people who know a lot about Tolkien know that long before he ever made Middle Earth, he'd created the languages. You know, he referred to them as his silly fairy languages, because, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but he was a bit of a geek in that direction. It was his hobby. It was his passion, his something bordering on a compulsion. That's what I think. If you're a geek for something, you have this joy and obsession in a subject, and it doesn't matter what that is. And Tolkien had that for language. So then when it came time and he wanted to write a story, those languages came into the story because that's what he loved. And for me, when I wanted to write a story, what I loved was a lot of this traditional fantasy that I'd always read. So I thought, I want to do something different. I want to tell this different sort of story, a smaller story, a personal story, emotional, focused on the character. But at the same time, I want people to read it and hopefully feel the way I felt when I was 14 and I read this marvelous fantasy world. When you explore a different world, there can be a sense of discovery. There's, you know, in the same way you mentioned with Philip Pullman, there's the possibility of this, you know, that the alternate universes is very fascinating. Similarly, I think a secondary world, a world which is not our own, if we explore that, that gives us a wealth of experience that we can gain no other way. It's almost like travel, except it's travel that you can only gain through reading.
Yes. And a lot of the things that our children have been growing up with, the different cartoon series where it's full of the imagined spaceships and incredible things that happen that you can do at the drop of a hat. But you've put this, these are people who feel and think and hurt and worry and weep and struggle as we do, but set in a different world. And unlike the Philip Pullman, they don't find access to special equipment like the knife through which you can slice through a section of a wall and find yourself in another place. You have them with incredible powers of the mind. And this is something that, who knows, with this new exploration of the brain, might not be a whole new universe discovered, because people realize just how little we know about the brain. But this book, it's fascinating, the scenes that you describe when Votha is trying to bind the hand of Divi and isn't quite strong enough because he's constantly being assailed by Ambrose, who doesn't know that it is deadly enemy that he's actually interfering with the comfort. He'd be delighted to find out. But how careful Votha has to be not to let Ambrose know how close he has come to destroying what he loves and does.
Yeah,
I love the episode. I love the significance of music in your book. And his ability to win the world to his side because of his, it's not just ability or skill, it's the personification of the heart of the lute that he brings out that absolutely defeats all rational thought. You just respond to what he is bringing out of his instrument.
You know, and while it's true that I did want to bring in a lot of the things that I loved in fantasy and hopefully, you know, bring to a new generation of readers, you know, what I felt when I was reading some of those great books. And honestly, when I was reading some of those not so great books, you know, there's still sometimes beautiful moments in any book. But at the same time, there's a lot of things that happen traditionally in fantasy, which are only there because of tradition or complacency or maybe something that used to be very culturally common. And nowadays we've kind of grown beyond that, but the literature kind of moves behind the times sometimes. So I did want to leave some of that cliche behind.
Did you find it hard?
You know, actually it was really easy because if I tried to do it, well, and, you know, I did try to do it in some ways when I was in high school, and I tried to write that novel, but I was still too young, and I was still too much in love with it. I still was in that first flush of love with fantasy, and so I could not be critical of it in the proper way.
Did you find that you, looking back, were following in the footsteps of the writers that you had fallen in love with, and you had to get away from them
Absolutely.
To develop your own voice, you
Absolutely.
Might say.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what, you know, that's what we do just as a matter of course. That's a huge portion of being human. We see it and we want to emulate it. And so we read Tolkien and so we go, I have to make a new language all my own if I'm going to have a good fantasy novel. But no. That's what Tolkien did. Tolkien had elves and dwarves, and it was so compelling. He was the first to do it. And so everyone follows in those footsteps, and then everyone else follows in those footsteps. Tolkien casts this huge shadow over the genre. I refer to him as Granddaddy Tolkien. You can't escape his influence.
Patrick Rothfuss, author of The Kingkiller Chronicle, is my guest. We'll be back in a few minutes after a short arts calendar. Today in Little Rock, 2 p.m. at the Arkansas Arts Center, a gallery talk by Anne Wagner, curator of drawings, takes you into the treasures of Kenwood House. And there's a special English dinner, 5 to 8:30, in Best Impressions Restaurant, July the 18th. Weekend Theatre's production of Spamalot continues Fridays and Saturdays, 7:30, Sunday, 2:30 through July 28th, and at Murray's Dinner Playhouse, Southern Crossroads closes July the 20th. Exhibits at the Clinton Presidential Center, Historic Arkansas Museum, and Old State House can keep you out of the heat downtown. Opera in the Ozarks, near Eureka Springs. Today at 4 o'clock, see Madama Butterfly at Bentonville's Arend Art Center. The festival closes July the 19th. The last three performances, July 17th, Madama Butterfly, 18th, The Pirates of Penzance, and final curtain, July 19th, Elixir of Love, all three at 7:30 in the pavilion at Inspiration Point. Information on other events also on our online calendar at kuar.org. Now we return to Patrick Rothfuss, author of the fantasy Kingkiller Chronicle.
But once I really started to write it, I'd read 3,000 fantasy novels, and I'd begun to become irritated because I'd pick up a book and I'd think, and I'd be excited. I'm like, where's my tingle? Where's my excitement? Give me that feeling again. And then I'd read it and I'd be like, I know all this stuff already. I've seen the dwarves and elves and all the variations. I've seen the clashing armies and the siege of some important city. And so I almost had a list. I'm not going to lie. I did have a list. It might not have been written down, but I had a list of things which kept happening in fantasy that I was so irritated by, and I never wanted to see it again. The magic as an excuse to fill plot holes, you know, magic as deus ex machina, magic as plot spackle, you know, like a bonding compound that you can use to fill in because it's hard to write a good tight plot.
What you're saying is that the authors are trying to overset what they set in motion and let the characters take over.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it was at that point in my life much easier to kind of break away from some of those traditions because they had really begun to irritate me. Now, that caused a whole array of its own problems because I was a very green writer. And so I realized that I hated the concept of the mustache twirling evil enemy, you know, who for some reason wants to destroy the world or usher in an age of darkness. Because really, I mean, it's okay in certain places, but who really wants to destroy the world? I mean, all of your stuff is in the world, right? And even the bad guy has to realize that he won't be able to watch TV if he destroys the world. And what do you do after that? So that just doesn't make any sense to me. You know, magic, which can kind of just do anything, doesn't make any sense to me. I come from a science background. I was studying to be a chemical engineer. And so I wanted the magic to feel real.
Believable.
There you go. That's it. I absolutely wanted that verisimilitude. I wanted people to feel like, you know, honestly, the way that I felt about Narnia as a kid, where as a kid, I thought, if only I could find the right door. You know, I could open it and I could go through and I could be there because it felt that real to me. Now, and that sort of love and belief is very easy to come by maybe when you're 10, 11, 12. But I wanted to sell that to anyone who picked up the book, where it's like, it's not the world you know, but it should feel real enough that if you were there, it wouldn't be like a movie set.
And it draws the reader in. So you feel and you hurt and you worry and you die.
Yeah.
Just by virtue of what the characters are doing, what the people in the story are doing.
And you're right. The people have to be the most real part of anything. Because we'll accept the concept of a dragon. People will buy that. But people the characters have to be genuine humans.
And that's why I love both as friends, Simmons and Will.
Yeah.
And the lovely description of how Fela, is it?
Yeah.
Is suddenly brought up short when she looks at Simmons because she'd never noticed him before.
Yeah.
And he had suddenly come up with a careless comment that he could do something she couldn't.
Yeah.
And there's obviously something brewing there. He doesn't know, of course.
Because we never know.
But it's lovely in the way you get the reader. Well, I always get totally involved in a book that I love, that I get caught up with and could go back and read. And I was thinking while you were talking, mentioning Tolkien, and go back even further, the 19th century had some authors who obviously were trying the same thing. Think James Barrie.
Yes, absolutely.
Think, well, Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, yeah. George MacDonald.
Yes, and it was George MacDonald who wrote At the Back of the North Wind.
Oh, that, really?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I have read that then, because I read Lilith. I read, didn't he write The Goblin Princess as
right,
well?
Right, right.
Oh, that's great. I'm definitely going to have to find Back of the North Wind now. And it could be that I've read it and I've forgotten the title.
Yeah. And then Conan Doyle.
Yeah.
And even Rudyard Kipling has some wonderful fantasy short stories.
Yeah.
Have you read The Brushwood Boy?
No, I haven't.
It's a lovely story.
Is that Kipling? I need to get that under my belt. Well, and, you know, honestly, you know, since you've taken us back, the truth is, you know, people view fantasy as kind of it's a modern genre. You know, it's, and honestly, a lot of folks still view us as kind of like ghetto or pop or trashy literature. But honestly, like Shakespeare's best plays, I mean, Midsummer Night's Dream is like urban fantasy. Hamlet has a ghost. And without the ghost, the story does not work. It's not a pretend ghost, you know,
mm-hmm.
because more people than just Hamlet see it. And does that make Hamlet fantasy?
His humans and his death are all too real.
Yeah. You know, and it just because something has fantastic elements doesn't mean that it has to be fakey or childish or silly. A lot of times it's one fantastic element that throws everything. It sort of like casts a harsh light onto the rest of reality.
Well, you've only to look at the stories of the saints, of how they became
yes.
saints, who they saw, what they saw, how they convinced the friends they told or the people they told that what they saw was real.
Yep. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Well, and you can go like Gargantua and Pantagruel.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
that's another couple hundred years back.
Mm-hmm.
And then honestly, you get all the way back to the Odyssey. It's like, what makes that story really cool? Not the history so much. It's like they meet a witch and people get turned into pigs and he goes into hell. And you read it and you're like, this is really
huge,
pretty.
Huge one-eyed giants, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's nothing, no limit at all to what an inventive mind can put down. And out of that depiction of what you are creating comes the essence of what you're trying to release so that the reader, if he or she gets as involved in the story as you're hoping they will, and as I have done, then you don't need to convince me that this is true in terms of what you're looking for
right.
to give to us.
Right. Well, and, you know, and the Odyssey actually ends up being a great example because there are these fantastic elements, but what really you know, draws you into the story is Odysseus's cleverness. And sometimes he's arrogant. Well, most of the time he's arrogant. But the most touching, emotional part of the whole story, it has nothing to do with the fantasy. It's when he gets home and his dog, you know, is waiting for him. And you know, that's a great moment.
Because you know it's true.
Yes, it's true. Absolutely. Because there is that which can exist in fantasy that can be more true than mere truth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And was it? I'm spacing out on the name. He wrote The Man Who Was Thursday. C.K. Chesterton.
Chesterton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said, the purpose of fairy tales is not to tell us there are dragons, but to tell us that dragons can be beaten. And, you know, I can't think of a better, like, clarion call to everyone in this day and age, where back, think of most folk tales as coming from in these pre-industrial times. I mean, those were dark times, and the average person had very little power, very little control, money, resource. But truthfully, it's like they had it good compared to us, because, like, we are constantly aware of these terrible powers in operation. And it's not like the nebulous potential of some god of the sea that'll wreck your boat. It's like there are corporations that will kill you and never suffer a scratch because of that.
And you still have mysteries, yeah, like the Bermuda Triangle that nobody can explain.
Exactly.
And so you begin to wonder just what else is out there.
Exactly. But what better thing to teach people nowadays that we're not talking about dragons all the time. Sometimes, yes, we're talking about dragons. But the story of someone who goes up against an impossibly powerful foe is nice to hear in this day and age, because we feel constantly confronted with impossible, powerful forces, whether they be corporate interests or government movements or the school board, you know, or sometimes our parents, depending on how old we are. It's like that's a great lesson for anyone to get at any point in their life. Mm-hmm.
When you write this particular trilogy, when you started it and got through it, do you have to wait for the characters to wake from sleep and force you to put it down on paper?
Those are the good days, when you feel moved to write and it fills you with sort of an electricity. And I used to think that's all that writing was, because I was a hobby writer.
Yes.
And since then, I've been having to learn about being a professional writer. There's kind of a myth that surrounds the author. I think of it as the myth of the author, where we're some sort of conduit, we're inspired. And that means we can have writer's block, which is some sort of mystical thing in the midst of which you cannot produce. That's kind of cheap. That's like a terrible excuse, because sometimes a plumber doesn't want to plumb either. But he doesn't wake up in the morning and go, oh, my plumbing muse is not upon me. I have plumber's block. I can't plumb. No, as a professional writer, sometimes even when you aren't filled with the love of it, you have to sit down and do your job.
And that's why, in a way, it's kind of a discipline that you've set yourself free.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've been slowly learning that discipline, because I built a lot of bad habits writing 15 years on this book before it was ever published, writing purely from a place of excitement and love. And then suddenly they're like, great, let's have another one in a year. And it's a whole different mental place to come from.
The Pullman was a trilogy. Tolkien was a trilogy. So you're in the tradition, but again, as a tradition exists at all in fantasy, you make your own.
Yeah. Yeah. And those are my favorite writers, who are keeping the best, and then if they decide to go off the path and pursue whatever delights them, those are the books that I love to read. And in reading them, I am surprised at where they go. That's the best part. That's the best part of any literature. And the best thing about fantasy is that there is so much more path to depart from and so much more exploration that you can do.
That was Patrick Rothfuss, whose first two books in his Kingkiller Chronicle have caught the interest of the world of fantasy literature. The Name of the Wind and The Wise Man's Fear are in paperback from Door Books, distributed by Penguin Group, USA, Inc. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR's College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio.